KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Public media is meant to be an independent source of information. It is protected in the statute that established the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
NPR files suit against President Trump's executive order targeting funding for public media.
For Tuesday, May 27th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration is asking federal agencies to cancel their remaining contracts with Harvard University.
Harvard's president is pushing back.
The research funding is given to universities to carry out work that the federal government designates as high priority work.
And elsewhere, cuts to federal education spur fears for after-school programs.
I could see it hindering the progress of our community if we didn't have safe and supportive places for our youth that support their academic success.
Those stories ahead after today's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A federal judge has struck down President Trump's executive order targeting the law firm WilmerHale, marking the third time a court has permanently blocked one of Trump's punitive orders against a big law firm. More from NPR's Ryan Lucas.
In his 73-page ruling, U.S. District Judge Richard Leon says that the cornerstone of the American justice system is an independent judiciary and an independent bar willing to tackle unpopular cases. For some 250 years, he says, no executive order had been issued challenging these fundamental rights. Until now, with President Trump's executive orders targeting several big law firms. That includes the executive order in this case, targeting the firm of WilmerHale. Now, Judge Leon has found that the order against WilmerHale is unconstitutional and has struck it down in its entirety. The order follows two similar rulings earlier this month from two other federal judges, striking down Trump's orders targeting two other prominent law firms. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Big cuts to Medicaid in the tax bill House Republicans passed are sparking concerns around the country that millions could lose health coverage. But feelings are complicated in one Arizona county, as Noam Levy reports.
Like a lot of rural places around America, Gila County, Arizona has become increasingly dependent in recent years on government health insurance like Medicaid. But many people in this copper mining center in the mountains east of Phoenix also say there's plenty of waste that should be trimmed. Debbie Cox works at a property management company. She has tenants who rely on Medicaid, she says.
It's not that I don't see the need for it. I see the need for it literally on a weekly basis. But I also see a need for revamping it significantly because it's been taken advantage of for so long.
How many people are actually taking advantage of Medicaid and how much waste there is are hotly debated. That debate will be front and center as the Senate prepares to take up the House GOP plan.
That's Noam Levy with our partner KFF Health News. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia is preparing not for peace but for new offensives. NPR's Polina Livnova reports from Kyiv.
In recent days, Russia has launched more than 900 drones on Ukraine. Zelensky says it's a sign that Russia wants to continue the war. In his address, he asked Ukraine's allies for new sanctions. Russia deserves full-scale pressure, he says, everything that can be done to limit its military capabilities. Meanwhile, Russian forces have occupied four villages in the northeastern Sumy region. Local authorities report the Russians are trying to advance to take more territories under control. Polina Litvinova, NPR News.
SpaceX's Starship lifted off successfully. It appears to have quickly run into trouble. Shortly after lift off, Starship went into an uncontrolled spin. It is now said to have re-entered somewhere over the Indian Ocean. You're listening to NPR. A new report says the potency of street fentanyl being sold illegally in the U.S. has dropped sharply. NPR's Brian Mann reports the government says a decline in purity may be contributing to a national decline in fatal drug overdoses.
Fentanyl is the leading cause of street drug deaths in the U.S., but a report released by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration shows the purity of illegal fentanyl being sold by drug cartels has dropped sharply. According to the DEA, the change may be due to actions by the Chinese government, which has cracked down on companies that manufacture chemicals used to make fentanyl. The drop in fentanyl purity coincides with the national decline in U.S. street drug overdoses, with roughly 30,000 fewer deaths reported in 2024. It's not all good news. Dealers are mixing other toxic chemicals into street drugs, including xylazine, a tranquilizer that causes severe skin wounds. Brian Mann, NPR News.
For a group of the nation's top spellers, this year's annual Scripps National Spelling Bee has special significance. It is the 100th anniversary of the spell-off, which was first held in 1925 when the Louisville Courier-Journal invited other newspapers to host spelling bees and send their champions to Washington. The annual spelling bee is now held just outside the nation's capital. This year is actually the 97th bee, since it was canceled from 1943 through 1945 during World War II, and again in 2020 due to COVID-19. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street today. The Dow is up 740 points to 42,343. The Nasdaq rose 461 points. The S&P was up 118 points. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. At 8:14 this morning, an email landed in my inbox and the inboxes of every other journalist here in our newsroom. Subject line, today NPR and three member stations filed suit against the recent EO. Well, the recent EO is President Trump's executive order targeting federal funding for NPR and PBS. The lawsuit was filed this morning in federal court here in D.C. It argues that Trump's EO is a clear violation of the Constitution and First Amendment protections for freedom of speech and association and freedom of the press. Well, when NPR is in the news, we report on ourselves as we would any other organization. So we have invited NPR President and CEO Catherine Marr to walk downstairs from her office here at headquarters into Studio 31 to take our questions. Catherine, welcome.
Lovely to be here.
In the interest of transparency, I want to note we asked to interview you because you're a stakeholder in this news story. You don't know what I'm about to ask. You had no input into these questions.
That's right.
Okay, so to the questions. The lawsuit cites NPR's First Amendment right, quote, to be free from government attempts to control private speech, as well as retaliation aimed at punishing and chilling protected speech, end quote. Can you explain in plain English what that means, what the thrust of this lawsuit is?
So NPR is a private organization, and we have the right as a media organization to make our own editorial choices about what it is that we cover and how we cover it. And what we found in the executive order was that the order discusses the need to end federal funding based on the accusation that we are not presenting fair, unbiased news. So from our perspective, what that means is that the order implies that NPR needs to change its editorial posture if we are to receive federal funding. It's very clear from the Public Broadcasting Act that public media is meant to be an independent source of information. And in fact, it is protected in the statute that established the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We believe that this is an infringement on NPR's First Amendment rights, but it is also an infringement on those rights of our station, both their editorial First Amendment rights and their rights to associate with NPR if they are unable to use their funds to choose to air our programming.
So the argument, as I understand what you're saying, is that NPR, like any other news organization in the United States, is free to choose what it covers, how it covers it, what language we use to do so.
That's correct. And even though we receive federal funding, we are still protected by those same rights.
There's a line that jumped out at me that I marked in the lawsuit, and I'll quote it. It is not always obvious when the government has acted with a retaliatory purpose in violation of the First Amendment, but this wolf comes as a wolf.
Antonin Scalia.
Yeah.
It's a great line.
The late conservative Supreme Court Justice Scalia. What does it mean here?
In this instance, it is evident from the president's executive order, as well as statements released by the White House and prior statements by the president, that we are being punished for our editorial choices.
NPR is suing alongside Aspen Public Radio, Colorado Public Radio, and KSUT Public Radio. Why? Why sue with Colorado stations?
Well, it wasn't actually intentional to choose all stations from one state. It just so happened that we were looking for stations that represented an urban area, rural areas, and perhaps a more diverse region. And so in the case of KSUT, that is a station that was actually created as a tribal station by the Southern Ute Tribe. So those stations represent the diversity that public radio offers in terms of the communities that it serves, and we felt like they would be good co-plaintiffs in this instance, and they agreed.
NPR has 246 member stations. Why aren't others in the mix?
We were looking for three co-plaintiffs that would allow for us to represent that diversity and move quickly to file this complaint.
What about PBS? Because the executive order targeted funding to NPR and PBS. Why is PBS not suing alongside NPR?
Well, PBS is a separate organization. We know from their statement when the executive order came out that they similarly find this order to be unlawful.
Do you worry about further retaliation? We're witnessing with Harvard what happens when an institution decides to stand up and fight back.
We definitely thought about what the consequences might be when we move forward to file the suit. And I should say that we are not choosing to do this out of politics. We are choosing to do this as a matter of necessity and principle. All of our rights that we enjoy in this democracy flow from the First Amendment, freedom of speech, association, freedom of the press. When we see those rights infringed upon, we have an obligation to challenge them. And that's what's at stake here. Retaliation is something we all think about, and yet the principle of what we do and how we do it, we have to defend our editorial integrity and the integrity of those rights.
For people listening, will NPR sound any different as this plays out?
No, I don't believe so. The entire point of going forward with this litigation is to protect our editorial independence. And as you started this segment by saying, there is a firewall between the newsroom and management, such as myself. I believe that the way that we do our work and the way that we are successful is by pursuing journalism that is excellent. And so I don't think we'll sound different. I think we'll sound exactly as we are, fair, responsible, nonpartisan, and seeking the facts.
Last thing, Catherine Marr, the backdrop here is, of course, bigger than NPR. It's bigger than public broadcasting. We are witnessing a wider assault by the Trump administration on a free press. Are you speaking with leaders of other news organizations about how to navigate this moment? Are you getting support from other news organizations?
Yes, I've had a number of conversations with leaders of larger media organizations, even than NPR. And I do believe that many of us feel as though this is a very difficult moment for this profession, also a difficult moment for our role as the press in democracy. And I think that that is the, without sounding grandiose, I think that's what animates many people who step into newsroom roles, leadership roles at media organizations. And so we're feeling not just the importance of the moment in terms of operations of an NPR or another media company, but really sort of the existential moment for what is it that we're doing to serve the American public right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Catherine Marr, NPR's CEO and president. And NPR did reach out to the White House for comment on the lawsuit. Here is what we heard back today from White House spokesperson Harrison Fields. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, is creating media to support a particular political party on the taxpayer's dime. Therefore, the president is exercising his lawful authority to limit funding to NPR and PBS. Mr. Fields continues, quote, "The president was elected with a mandate to ensure efficient use of taxpayer dollars, and he will continue to use his lawful authority to achieve that objective."
A video showing French President Emmanuel Macron's wife shoving him in the face has gone viral. Macron says that the two were just sharing a moment of closeness. As NPR's Jacqueline Diaz reports, this moment has taken on a life of its own in pro-Russian media.
The video is just a few seconds long. French President Emmanuel Macron is standing in the open doorway of a plane after touching down in Vietnam. He's standing in profile talking when suddenly a pair of red-sleeved arms reach out and push him in the face. Moments later, he puts a smile on his face and waves at the camera. French First Lady Brigitte Macron, wearing a red jacket, appears as they leave the plane. Macron's office says it was just the married couple sharing a silly moment. So why has it gained so much attention?
If any video like that came out for anyone in his position, it would go viral in today's digital environment.
That was Darren Linville, a Clemson University professor specializing in social media disinformation. Linville says he's seen the video take hold in corners of Russian media and pro-Russian propaganda on social media. Disinformation experts like Linville say pro-Russian actors are using the video to suggest that Macron is weak and emasculated.
Bad actors, especially the Russians, take advantage of real videos like this all of the time to spin the message and the story that they want to tell.
This is not the first time Macron has been targeted on social media. When Macron met German and British leaders earlier this month on a train to Ukraine, some conspiracy theorists said photos of the meeting showed a bag of cocaine on the table. Macron's office said it was a tissue, and Macron's office said the conspiracy theories were fake news spread by France's enemies. Linville says Macron is a prime target for misinformation.
He is the leader of the Western world, the leader, the most prominent advocate and voice in NATO, and that makes him target number one for Russia.
Nina Khrushcheva, a professor of international affairs at the New School, says that to Russians, the video is presented to make Macron look weak compared to Putin. Macron has wanted the West to amp up pressure on Putin over the war in Ukraine.
Because Macron is so big on being tough on Russia, and they're showing him like, oh, he's tough on Russia. Look at this. He's not even tough on his wife.
She said there's an opportunity for pro-Russian voices to present it as a contrast to the strongman image of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The goal is to undermine the legitimacy of Macron and the West, according to Linville.
Russia and China and other countries that stand in opposition to the West and to NATO are looking to chip away at what remains of those traditions and those standards.
And Linville says these attacks on social media against leaders like Macron, who are trying to uphold democracy in Europe, will likely continue. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. After-school programs in rural and low-income parts of the country are not only free childcare, they also bolster student learning beyond the school day, and they're essential for letting working parents work. But now, many fear that President Trump's proposed education cuts may threaten federally funded after-school programs. NPR's Janaki Mehta went to a rural school district in central Maine to see one such program.
In a building right next to the Skowhegan Area Middle School's hockey field, the smell of freshly baked granola is wafting from an industrial kitchen.
Get your hands washed. We got things to do.
Retired chef Brenda Madden leads Cooking Club. On today's agenda,
we're going to begin our journey into France. You are going to be making parfait cups.
Students in bandanas and chef's hats are in a sort of assembly line, putting together yogurt parfaits, including sixth grader Blaine Hart.
We're making it like the French flag, so red for strawberries, white for yogurt, and then blue for blueberry.
After school, a cooking club is just one of the many activities students of the Skowhegan Area School District get to pick from. Part of their focus is on multicultural cuisine.
In the beginning of their culinary experience, they would say they'd want chicken nuggets and french fries for supper.
That's Dawn Fickett. She's the director of the after-school program here.
After a year of cooking with Brenda, they will be able to tell you that they would love to, you know, whip up paninis with a variety of cheeses and meats or veggies.
This kind of exposure to new cuisines, cultures, and handy life skills are all part of why after-school programs are a boon in this rural and low-income community. This program exists because the district got a federal grant for after-school programs in low-income areas. But President Trump's recently released budget proposal calls for significant cuts to education programs as his administration tries to reduce the government's role in schools. Advocates for after-school programs like Dawn Fickett are worried the grant could be on the chopping block in the future.
I could see it really hindering the progress of our community if we didn't have safe and supportive places for our youth that help support their academic success.
Can you come to the fridge with me and we can get some of the ingredients?
Over in a corner of the kitchen, 7th grader Dylan Kirk is busy decorating croissants.
And I just drizzled some chocolate and some dried up fruit. Miss Brenda told me to make it fancy, so I tried my best.
Kirk says he wouldn't have thought to combine these flavors before he joined Cooking Club. He also loves outdoor adventure and robotics, some of the other activities at the after-school program. And these clubs aren't just a fun, safe way to spend time after school. Fickett says she works closely with school day teachers to make sure they sneak relevant learning into the after-school program.
Nutrition, literacy, STEM, and multicultural education. We can pull threads of all of those within cooking. They're reading recipes, multiplying, subtracting.
How much salt did you add?
A whole cup of salt.
Meeting academic goals is part of the requirement for the federal grant. Fickett says last year, 91% of the low-performing elementary school students in the program showed improvement in reading. And the students meet all kinds of non-academic goals, too.
Something that Brenda does really well is establish how we work best together as a group, how we problem solve, social relational skills that our youth absolutely need for success.
Research also shows that after-school programs play a big role in making sure kids show up to school. In fact, attending school is a requirement for participating in this after-school program, something sixth grader Molly Fitzpatrick thinks is working.
I don't know, like, I'll be excited to go to school on Monday because I don't want to miss cooking, right?
I don't know even know what that is, but it looks good with strawberries.
As cooking club comes to a close, students sit around a table.
How about
we set some flowers on the table.
They've laid it neatly with a floral tablecloth, plates, and cutlery. They're sitting around the chocolate and apricot drizzled croissants Dylan Kirk prepared earlier. Producer Janet Wujong Lee takes a temperature on how the students rate the dish.
Out of 10, how was your rating?
I'm struggling to get 10.
It's pretty regularly at 10.
As the students leave, parents start showing up to pick up their kids, including Dylan Kirk's mom, Cynthia Kirk, who says she couldn't imagine their family life without the after-school program. She and her husband both work full-time, so the childcare is essential.
Instead of him just going home and being home alone, he can experience all these different activities instead, plus get some extra study time because we're a pretty busy family in the evenings.
Now she worries federal cuts could mean this essential program could go away.
That should be bottom of the list when it comes to cuts. The kids are our future. We have to invest in them.
The future of grants like the one funding this after-school program will soon be in the hands of Congress.
Does everybody have what they need?
Until then, the students at Cooking Club are still relishing their creations.
So who's pleased with themselves today?
Yeah, me.
Happy dance time?
Yeah.
Do it. Break it out.
Janaki Mehta, NPR News, Skowhegan, Maine.
The American Music Awards, the one the fans vote for, they were last night.
And apparently what the people want are return performances by some of their favorite artists. Side Eyes, Billie Eilish, and of course Beyonce.
Jennifer Lopez, she hosted this year's awards in Las Vegas.
And J-Lo would not be J-Lo if she didn't grace us with a performance, of course. It was her first time hosting the awards since 2015.
Welcome to the American Music Awards. Live from Fountain Blue, Las Vegas!
J-Lo was not the only legend gracing the stage with a triumphant return.
My story, my family's story, it's truly an American story. This would have only happened in America.
Janet Jackson. Miss Janet herself was there to accept the Icon Award. And of course, like J-Lo, she performed because, you know, diva's got a diva.
Oh, I love a Janet performance. It was her first one on TV in 7 years.
We mentioned Billie Eilish and Beyonce. They were among the current stars who won the night.
Eilish was nominated 7 times and won 7 times.
Oh my God, Artist of the Year. This is so crazy. I feel speechless.
No surprise there.
Beyonce took home the awards for Favorite Country Album and Favorite Female Country Artist. Again, no surprise and no controversy there. I mean, have you even heard Cowboy Carter, Mary Louise?
Indeed, I have. Now, what was controversial about last night came after a viral moment between two country singers, Shaboozey and Megan Maroney.
And this award went to the Carter family, who basically invented country music.
This year's AMA
Maroney is talking about the Carter family, a notable country music group.
You can't see it there, but Shaboozey gave Maroney a very clear side eye when she said who invented country music, reigniting an age-old debate about the genre's origins.
Shaboozey responded once the internet chatter had died down, saying the real history of country music is about people coming together despite their differences and embracing and celebrating the things that make us alike.
Well, with J-Lo and Janet back on stage, TV is back. Am I right, Mary Louise?
You are so right as ever, Elsa. Listen, the American Music Awards, you can call them whatever you want. You cannot call them boring.
This is NPR News.
The U.S. and Iran have resumed indirect talks aimed at reaching a new nuclear deal. President Trump said the discussions were productive and that there could be good news soon, but negotiators on both sides have drawn hard lines, especially over Iran's right to enrich uranium. So what is Iran's position, and is there any real chance of an agreement? Find out more tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you. It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Chicago is still buzzing with Pope fever, with one of their own now in the papal seat.
Can that excitement help Sunday attendance?
The city's churches hope so.
I think that he is going to help people take a second look at the church.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Officials with the United Nations say there have been heartbreaking scenes in Gaza where Palestinians are seen swarming a food distribution site set up by a U.S.-backed private foundation. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the U.N. is not taking part.
Video showing desperate Palestinians scrambling to get food at new distribution sites are hard to watch, says UN spokesman Stéphane Dujarric.
For us, humanitarian aid needs to be distributed in a way that is safe under principles of independence, impartiality, in the way we've always done it.
The way this new group is trying to deliver aid does not meet those standards, he says, and that's why the UN is not taking part. U.S. State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce says Hamas tried to stop the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation from delivering aid, but she says the food is starting to flow for the first time in months. Israel had been blocking all aid. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Stocks rallied on Wall Street today after President Trump decided to delay a steep tax on European imports for at least another month. And NPR's Scott Horsley says stocks regained much of the ground they lost last week.
Over the long weekend, Trump said he would wait until at least early July to impose a 50% tariff on goods from the European Union. That provides at least a little time for the two sides to negotiate a trade deal and possibly avoid a punishing tit-for-tat tariff battle. Trump took to social media saying the EU leaders have called to quickly set up meeting dates. For now, imports from Europe are being taxed at a 10% rate, which is still much higher than before Trump returned to the White House. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Consumer confidence also improved for the first time in 5 months. The numbers on Wall Street, the Dow up nearly 2%. This is NPR. In Connecticut, thousands of machinists at jet engine manufacturer Pratt & Whitney will return to work tomorrow after a three-week strike. Molly Ingram from member station WSHU reports.
More than 3,000 workers were on strike, the machinist union's first at the plants since 2001. It came months after the company began furloughing workers despite reporting increased profits and having $100 billion in back-owed work, including contracts with the U.S. government. The new four-year agreement was approved by 74% of the union members that voted on Tuesday morning. The deal includes yearly wage increases, higher pension payments, and more flexible workweek options. A Pratt & Whitney spokesperson said this was the outcome everyone was working toward. For NPR News, I'm Molly Ingram in Connecticut.
Well, today is the final boarding call, if you would, for free bags at Southwest Airlines. That's if you want to book a flight without getting hit by new bag fees starting tomorrow. Southwest is abandoning its decades-long bags fly free policy, which actually set the budget carrier apart from its rivals. Beginning tomorrow, checking the first bag will cost you $35, $45 for the second. Southwest has been under pressure to boost its profits and is also ditching its open seating policy later this year. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station
and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Trump administration is asking federal agencies to cancel their remaining federal contracts with Harvard University. The administration has accused the school of anti-Semitism and race discrimination, including in the admissions process, all of which Harvard denies. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny joins us now to bring us up to date. Hi, Alyssa.
Hello.
Okay, it just feels like lately this has been this constant tug of war between Harvard and the Trump administration. Can you just catch us up real quick on what the latest is?
Okay, so a letter from the U.S. General Services Administration, dated Tuesday today, tells government agencies to review current contracts with Harvard. Mm-hmm. It asks them to terminate contracts where possible, or if they're critical, to find an alternative vendor. And these latest contracts under review are estimated to be worth about $100 million. Agencies are supposed to submit a list of contracts that they have terminated with the university by June 6th.
Okay, and this is in addition to a bunch of grants that have already been frozen, right?
That's right. In April, the administration froze more than $2 billion to Harvard and its affiliates, including local hospitals, grants in nearly every subject from cancer research to new defense technology. Harvard has not responded to NPR's request for comment on the latest request from GSA, but the school is suing the Trump administration to block the federal funding freeze, claiming that the administration's moves are unlawful and that these cuts threaten academic freedom and First Amendment rights. And a hearing in that case is scheduled for July.
Okay, and remind us, what are the administration's reasons for continuing to go after Harvard?
Well, they frame this as a fight for civil rights. In letters and documents, the government has accused the university of liberal bias, of considering race in its admissions policies, despite a Supreme Court ban on affirmative action. They have accused the school of coordinating with the Chinese Communist Party and allowing anti-Semitism on campus. Here's a clip from President Trump from the campaign trail.
We spend more money on higher education than any other country, and yet they're turning our students into communists and terrorists and sympathizers of many, many different dimensions.
So he's been talking about kind of going after Harvard, going after elite universities for a long time. And in addition to cutting grant funding, the president has also threatened to revoke the school's tax-exempt status.
Right. And then just last week, the White House tried to block Harvard from enrolling international students, right?
That's exactly right. Harvard sued, and then a federal judge temporarily blocked the government from doing that. But Harvard has nearly 7,000 students from more than 100 countries, and it's left many of them uncertain over their future or if they'll even be able to enroll next semester.
Yeah. Can you just explain for me, Alyssa? It seemed like the administration was withholding funds from a bunch of schools, but it feels like now President Trump is focusing pretty intently on Harvard. Why do you think that is?
Well, Harvard was really the first and really the only university to push back against the administration's demands. They're the oldest and wealthiest school in the country. Many colleges look to Harvard to lead the way. Alan Garber, Harvard's president, told NPR's Steve Inskeep that this fight impacts everyone.
Sure, it hurts Harvard, but it hurts the country because, after all, the research funding is not a gift.
One of Garber's major arguments is that cutting off research funding for things like diabetes treatments and obesity intervention doesn't have a clear link to accusations of anti-Semitism or racial discrimination.
That is NPR's Alyssa Nadworny. Thank you, Alyssa.
Thank you.
Now that the world's most famous Catholic is an American from Chicago, church leaders there are hoping his papacy will inspire more people to take up Catholicism. Some hope Pope Leo XIV will bring new energy to a church that's been on a steady decline in Chicago. Adora Namagede reports.
Benison's Bakery in suburban Chicago has a new popular baked good for sale, Pope cookies. Supervisor Jennifer Fournier recalls,
as soon as it was then verified that he was from Chicago, the owner, Jory Downer, gave a call to the bakery and said, no one can leave.
Downer saw the business opportunity. The team raced to develop the cookies. They feature a smiling picture of Pope Leo XIV, surrounded with sprinkles colored to match the Vatican flag. They're a mainstay now. People are ordering them across the country.
And I kind of thought that it would have died out by now, but nope.
The bakery is just one example of a local business offering papal paraphernalia. From the Pope t-shirts to a graphic installation at the White Sox Stadium, there's a lot of excitement around Pope Leo in Chicagoland. Cardinal Blaise Supich, Archbishop of Chicago, says with all this energy around Pope Leo, he hopes the Pope will inspire more people in the area to consider more seriously practicing Catholicism or even becoming church leaders.
I think that he, as a Southsider growing up in Chicago, is going to be able to offer a message to young people today about the importance of thinking about serving in a lifelong commitment to the church.
Supich says one of the main reasons the Archdiocese closed more than 100 parishes 3 years ago was a shortage of priests. There are less Catholics here overall now. In 1970, there were nearly 2.5 million Catholics in Chicago. Today, there are about 2 million, according to church statistics.
The man is genuinely authentic. He's going to be able to speak to Americans in a language they understand as an American speaking. I think that he is going to help people to take a second look at the church.
The Archdiocese will hold a mass in June to celebrate him. But this interest in the world's most important Catholic leader is set against a story of Catholic decline in the city. The Church of Pope Leo's Youth closed in 2011.
I am standing outside the Pope's childhood parish. It's called St. Mary Church. And you can really tell the area is a bit economically depressed. The church has a big hole in the top window behind a Mary statue. It's just kind of an unassuming spot on the south side of Chicago.
The building has not been open in more than 10 years. Yet, Dottie Milton keeps seeing people drive through this quiet part of the south side. I chatted with her while she pulled weeds on her church lawn, just down the street from the Pope's.
I have seen a lot of people, you know, lately in the neighborhood, viewing the church, stopping by, taking pictures, standing, kneeling, prayer, and all of that.
Acts of faith in front of an abandoned building that's taken on new meaning. Even people who have not stopped by the Pope's church feel that there is something more special about Chicago because of the Pope's history. Liam Grimes is a junior at DePaul University who visits the Catholic Center between classes to pray and socialize. He says he and other students are excited about Pope Leo.
And there's been like a buzz, I guess, to it because it's an American Pope and we're in Chicago, where he's from.
While Grimes is happy the Pope is a Chicagoan, he will focus his energy on praying for him.
I pray, and that we should all pray, that Pope Leo is a holy man and is faithful and does what he believes that God wants him to do as the leader of the Catholic Church.
Ultimately, DePaul Professor Michael Budde says Pope Leo is in a honeymoon period, and that may only last
until the person in charge has to make a controversial decision. And that might be quickly, that might be 6 months from now, but it's not the sort of thing that goes on forever.
Because although the Pope may have been raised in Chicago, he's the spiritual leader for 1.4 billion Catholics across the world. For NPR News, I'm Adora Namigadde in Chicago.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. At the same time that the Trump administration is moving to reverse electric vehicle promises made by the Biden administration, some states, even those led by Democrats, might be doing some of the same as they face budget shortfalls. Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters went to see how that's playing out at a dealership in the Twin Cities area.
Rob Powell walks through one of his cornerstone auto dealerships. He stops by the inventory desk and asks for the keys to an electric vehicle.
We don't have one.
No.
Wow, not used or new. Didn't expect that.
Powell says Cornerstone has around 500 new cars across the Twin Cities. Just seven of those are EVs. Now that could mean EVs are especially popular, but to Powell,
there's just not as many of them as there probably should be or used to be.
Every good public radio story starts with stepping inside a car and going for a ride, but we can't do that today. So
no.
What should that tell me?
I think that's partially through demand, through our ordering process.
And part, he says, it's about the number of cars manufacturers think they can sell in this market. And that number might soon tumble lower. 2 years ago in Minnesota, lawmakers tried to encourage drivers to purchase electric vehicles by offering big rebates. This year, those rebates are gone. And in their place, a hike on the surcharges on those same cars.
You know, we're coming off of Minnesota having its electric vehicle rebate program, which was very popular, but only funded for 1 year.
Carolyn Berninger is with Drive Electric Minnesota, a trade group looking to accelerate the adoption of EVs.
And now we're kind of seeing the state go in the opposite direction.
That rebate program offered up to $2,500 for new EVs and $600 for purchases of used ones. But Berninger points out EV adoption in Minnesota is still very low. She's concerned customers won't want to go with an EV when they see that annual surcharge triple from $75 to $200 starting next year.
Hiking up fees, and particularly this $200 fee, would require electric vehicle owners to pay more in the electric vehicle fee than a lot of gas car owners pay through the gas tax.
Other states are also rolling EV incentives back. Colorado reduced its tax credit from $5,000 to $3,500. At the federal level, Congress voted to undo federal waivers for California. The White House wants to cancel funding for a $5 billion EV charging station grant program. Minnesota's Democratic Attorney General Keith Ellison is part of a multi-state coalition of AGs suing the Trump administration over the move.
The thing that's happened in the legislature I disagree with, but I can't claim it's unconstitutional. What the president is doing is unconstitutional and illegal, and that's why we're suing him for it.
At the Capitol in St. Paul, Democratic governor and former vice presidential candidate Tim Walz seems ready to pass the surcharge bill.
The gas tax is what how we fund our roads. And the argument is that EVs use our roads. They add to the maintenance of it. They should pay their fair share on that. And I think most EV owners agree with that.
The House here is tied between Republicans and Democrats this year. Democratic Representative Larry Kraft says he's disappointed lawmakers can't do more to curb climate change.
The climate doesn't give us a pause. The climate doesn't care about our politics. So the fact that we weren't able to make more progress, yes, I'm very disappointed, and I have renewed emphasis to work on it.
So at the same time that the Trump administration continues to disincentivize EV adoption, lawmakers, even Democrats, may charge Minnesotans a little more to keep their EV registrations up to date. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in St. Paul.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The federal government announced today yet another big change for COVID-19 vaccines. The Department of Health and Human Services suddenly dropped the recommendation that healthy pregnant women and healthy children get vaccinated against COVID. Now, federal officials say the change is warranted because of where we are in the pandemic. Independent experts are surprised and some are alarmed by the move. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein is here. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Give me a little more detail on what exactly the government announced today.
Yeah, sure. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced that if you're pregnant but healthy, and if your kids are healthy, the federal government is no longer routinely recommending COVID shots. The announcement came in a 58-second video that Kennedy posted on X. Let's listen to what he said.
I couldn't be more pleased to announce that as of today, the COVID vaccine for healthy children and healthy pregnant women has been removed from the CDC recommended immunization schedule.
In the video, he was flanked by FDA Commissioner Martin McCary and NIH Director Jay Bhattacharya, and they both essentially endorsed the decision.
And did they explain why?
Well, they said the decision was based on, quote, common sense and good science, and there isn't good data supporting continuing the shots for kids without any risk factors. Here's Kennedy again.
Last year, the Biden administration urged healthy children to get yet another COVID shot despite the lack of any clinical data to support the repeat booster strategy in children.
Okay,
HHS didn't answer any of NPR's specific questions on the change in recommendations, though.
Huh. Okay, I was gonna jump in and ask what kind of reaction you're hearing to all this.
Yeah, so public health and infectious disease experts I talked to today said they were shocked and confused by the decision because, first of all, the decision totally short-circuited the process. The independent advisory committee to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that usually comes up with these recommendations has been debating this very question, and they're scheduled to meet next month. And beyond that, outside experts are really worried what this means for healthy pregnant women and healthy kids.
Well, I mean, what does it mean for healthy pregnant women and healthy kids? Beyond the he said, she said, do they still need regular boosters?
You know, Mary Louise, it's true that most older, healthy kids don't tend to get very sick from COVID, and most parents long ago stopped getting their kids immunized, but some parents still want to get their kids shots, you know, to keep them from catching the virus and missing school, to, you know, protect them against long COVID and cut the chances that they'll infect vulnerable family members. But very young babies can get really sick from COVID, and they're too young to get vaccinated. So the only way to protect them is to immunize their moms while they're pregnant so the babies can get antibodies before they're born. I talked about this with Dr. Sean O'Leary. He heads the American Academy of Pediatrics Infectious Disease Committee.
It's really concerning because infants under 6 months of age actually have hospitalization rates similar to adults 65 to 74 years old. And so by removing the recommendation for pregnant women, that's really taking away the only way to protect those younger kids.
Because the change could very well mean insurance companies just won't pay for the shots for those kids anymore. And same goes for pregnant women who are also at very high risk of getting really sick if they catch COVID. So this could put a lot of kids and pregnant women in a very tricky position.
And PR's Rob Stein. Thanks, Rob.
Sure thing, Mary Louise. Nice to be here.
The safety of everything we eat, from milk and macaroni to meat and lettuce, is monitored by three federal agencies, the Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Agriculture, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. All have faced deep cuts even before the Trump administration's reductions. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
Paula Soldner's inspected meat and poultry plants around southern Wisconsin for 38 years. It required daily checkups on factories to ensure slicers were cleaned on schedule, for example. Her sign-off allowed plants to put red, white, and blue USDA inspected labels on grocery store packages.
I'm talking brats, hot dogs, summer sausage, pizzas.
Last month, Soldner took the Trump administration up on its offer of early retirement, joining an exodus from the Food Safety and Inspection Service that began under President Biden. Soldner says remaining inspectors must now visit 8 facilities, double the usual number, each day. That's not possible, she says, so it's unclear how much food is legitimately earning that stamp of approval.
As long as that stamp is there, yeah, it can be sold. But did that plant receive that daily inspection from inspection personnel? In my mind, that's a huge question mark.
Soldner chairs her union. The National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals represents some 6,500 inspectors like her. She says consumers today are more vulnerable to deadly listeria outbreaks like last year's, traced to an unsanitary factory run by Boar's Head.
Do I foresee another Boar's Head situation? Absolutely. Absolutely. I worry about the public.
The country's food safety system is complex. Federal agencies coordinate and fund most food safety programs, while state and local officials do a lot of work on the ground. Most produce is inspected by states, for example, but the FDA's national labs test samples for pathogens. Often, it's local health officials who first report foodborne illness cases to the CDC. In emails, FDA and USDA spokesmen said streamlining operations will not alter commitment to food safety. The USDA yesterday said it boosted state funds for food safety inspections by $14.5 million. In a separate emailed statement, the agency called inspectors, quote, critical, and therefore none were eligible for the administration's second early retirement offer. NPR reviewed emails, however, of USDA officials urging inspectors to take that deal, then confirming some qualified. Meanwhile, Sarah Sorcher, a policy expert at the Center for Science in the Public Interest, says the entire system is unraveling.
Our federal food safety system is teetering on the brink of a collapse.
She's most concerned about the loss of expertise. The Trump administration last month abruptly shuttered two of the FDA's 7 food testing labs, for example. The ensuing chaos delayed seafood inspections and routine produce testing, several FDA microbiologists told me. This month, the administration reopened the two labs. But Sosha says damage has been done.
It's as if you took a chainsaw and started cutting holes out of the walls of a house. You can't really point to the fact that the doors or windows are still there and say, don't worry, the house is secure.
Stephen Mandernack, director of the Association of Food and Drug Officials, says state and local officials also lost CDC funding for public outreach. He says that will delay response and tracking of outbreaks.
It could artificially make it look like, hey, food safety is great here, when the actuality is we just aren't looking for it as much.
He says we'd simply be less aware of the dangers. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from mall agents. And from the Skoll Foundation.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Says I.
Shh! Look out for the devil. Look out for the devil. Look out for the devil.
Oh, the devil with the devil, says I. You're so afraid of old man Satan. Now, why don't you stop your hesitating? You're gonna be a long time dead. So the devil with the devil, says I. You're always giving me the dickens, telling me that life's no easy pickings.